Good morning.
Good morning.
Going to get started here. So we've been working through, essentially, just kind of an introduction as to how to interpret Genesis. Remember that as we're doing this, that we're not trying to get through every single verse in the book. We're not trying to explain every detail. That would be wonderful. But we are trying to set a framework, a basic understanding, so you can know how to interpret Genesis. Is that causing any problems with the speaker? Okay, sorry. Better? All right. Trying to get a framework for how to understand the book of Genesis. And we've been talking about interpreting Genesis in its historical context. Interpreting Genesis in its historical context. And we've noted that there's a theme that runs through it. We said this last time together. When the people of Israel received the Pentateuch, they could see God's gracious hand all the way through their forefathers. And we noted this theme. It is God's gracious act in choosing Israel that is a central theme throughout the book of Genesis. I think we had that in your blanks last time. Did we do that? All right, thank you. All right, so I think on your notes, that is page number 5. Page number 5. So it's a central theme, all right? So that isn't to say that there aren't other important themes in Genesis, but that is a central theme. There is this movement towards seeing God bring about his chosen people, Israel. We also noted that you see this even in the genealogy throughout Genesis, when you go from Adam to Seth to Noah to Shem to Terah to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and the 12 tribes, that there are a lot of unexpected twists and turns in there. It's not the firstborn Cain that's chosen. It's ultimately it's Seth. Obviously, Cain disqualified himself. Noah doesn't choose his firstborn either. Shem is the one. You know, Abraham's technically his firstborn was Ishmael, and that wasn't the one that was chosen. Jacob, not Esau, and so on. And even among the 12 tribes, you have Judah emphasized in the prophetic section of Genesis 49 that we actually preached about last week, rather than the firstborn son. So there's some twists and turns, but it's showing all along the way how God is working out his plan in choosing the people of Israel. Now, clearly also God chose Israel out of the nations. We emphasize that just a little bit. Remember, you have the table of nations in Genesis chapter 10, where all the various people groups are described where they come from. That's right before the Tower of Babel. And even in that as well, we see God choosing Israel out from among them. Now, let's push this a little bit further and think about here today interpreting Genesis in light of the Pentateuch. And that's letter D in your notes. I don't think, did we get to this at all? I think we left off here, right? Okay, all right, good. I just wanted to make sure because I normally try to write something in my notes and I didn't do it. So I was this week trying to remember where we're at. Interpreting Genesis in light of the Pentateuch. Remember when we use the word Pentateuch, we're talking about first five books of the Old Testament, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. When we read the narrative sections of Genesis, we should read them in light of the whole Pentateuch. The whole Pentateuch. So there's your blank there. I think there's a blank. As noted above, there is a literary unity between the first five books of the Bible, a literary unity. So, as we mentioned last week, each of the books, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, they all do have some central themes on their own, but they are tied together. Moses has tied the whole of them together. Moses, number two, dedicates much of the Pentateuch to the formation of Israel as a nation at Sinai and the laws that come from God's people. Scholars will call these laws cultic regulations. All right, so there's a blank there for you, cultic regulations there under number two. When you hear that, that does not mean that they think Israel is a cult, okay? It's just that's not the idea behind that. It's just saying that they have things that hold their religion together. So sometimes you'll see Bible teachers or scholars, if you read a commentary, if they say that, don't automatically think, oh my goodness, they deny the Bible. That's not what they're doing. You'll see that phrase sometimes. So Moses dedicates much of the Pentateuch to talking about how Israel comes together as a nation and the rules, the laws that hold them together as a nation. That's one of the important parts of the whole of the Pentateuch, these first five books of the Bible. Now, Genesis, in many ways, becomes then an introduction to Moses' central themes of this nation being formed and the laws that hold it together. So we can say it this way, that Genesis 1 through 11, Genesis 1 through 11 form a prelude by showing us the universal history of mankind. So there's this kind of narrowing action that takes place in Genesis, where you have, you know, Genesis 1 through 11, it's just wide. Here's where everybody came from. And we're going to get this kind of funneling, narrowing effect down to the people of Israel when you read through the Pentateuch. That's what Moses, one of the key things that Moses is doing. So then Genesis 12 through 50 show Israel her ancestors. In addition, these chapters introduce Israel to her soon-to-be neighbors in Canaan, as well as Canaan herself. Now, first ancestor of the people of Israel, the one that at least is important in terms of their being formed as a nation, was Abraham. We get introduced to him in Genesis chapter 12. And then, of course, from there you have Isaac and Jacob, and then Jacob's 12 sons. But remember that the majority of what we see in Genesis 12 through 50, the majority of that actually takes place in Canaan, in the Promised Land. Even though Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and his 12 sons never actually possess that land. So the people of Israel, as they're reading about their history, they see, here's where everybody comes from. Now let's funnel it down to here's where we come from. And we get introduced to our forefathers, our ancestors, the ones whom God has made certain promises to, that we also, Israelites, receive. And also along the way, we get introduced to Canaan. They were in that land. They were in the land of Canaan. Right? Then Exodus through Deuteronomy tracks Israel's move from Egypt to Moab. And so I've totally ripped off a chart that comes from Kenneth Matthew's commentary on Genesis just to illustrate this, that you have this, you know, and he uses a little different way to illustrate this, that you have these movements in the Pentateuch. Okay, so there's some action happening here that Moses wants us to see. Moses, also letter B, Moses is also a key figure throughout the majority of the Pentateuch. The books of the Pentateuch are thus rightly called the books of Moses. Sometimes you'll hear people refer to the Pentateuch that way, the books of Moses. Now, when we read Genesis, we really don't see Moses, right? I mean, in fact, we don't see Moses. We might see some editorial comments by Moses. For instance, Genesis chapter 2, after we have the description of man and woman being brought together in marriage. Therefore, Moses says, a man shall leave his father and mother, be joined to his wife, and they shall be one flesh. So we have some editorial comments like that along the way, but Moses isn't prominent in Genesis. We don't see him until we get to the book of Exodus. But when you think about the whole of the Pentateuch, the whole of those first five books, Moses is like, he's a dominant figure throughout that. Okay, and so Genesis is kind of getting us to Moses and his interaction with the formation of the people of Israel. Moses also, in some sense, has ties to other parts of the book of the Pentateuch, specifically in Genesis. Right? This is something that we don't do very well. I think that's the right grammar. We don't do very well as most Americans, is we do not know how to read stories anymore. We don't know how to read narrative anymore. Ever since like the era of Dragnet, we just want the facts, ma'am. That's what we want. But narratives are designed, good narratives are designed to be read or spoken over and over and over again. And when you do that, there are certain themes that come up again and again and again. So, I don't know if I've used this illustration before. If I have, I'm sorry. Anybody ever read The Great Gatsby? A few of you have, okay? It's a gritty book, okay? A lot of not very Christian things happen in that book. The Great Gatsby, were we married? I think were we engaged? Yeah, and you had it for a literature class, and we read it together. What's that?
We were married,
yes. So we read it driving to church, I think, on Wednesday nights, because we drove 45 minutes away, so one of us would read and the other would listen. And, great fun, yeah. If you read The Great Gatsby, it's set in the Roaring Twenties, and it's full of the debauchery of the Roaring Twenties. The Roaring Twenties are called the Roaring Twenties for a reason. There's a lot of bad stuff that happened in American culture, especially higher American culture, right? But there's actually this metaphor that appears multiple times throughout the book. I'm not going to give you the punchline of the book or anything, but this will actually help you. And actually, I had a Casey's English professor actually mentioned this, and I actually talked to him later about it. He said that if you're going to read The Great Gatsby, pay attention to the all-seeing eye. There's this billboard with this eye that looks upon the people of the city all the time. And the eye is really important because it helps you to see that there is someone who does actually see what's really going on. It's kind of ominous. All right? Read the book. It's a great classic. All right? There's a reason why it's considered an American classic. Okay? Now, when you read narrative like that, now that's a fictional story, that metaphor, that thing is designed to keep coming up to show you a theme. But even when you have a true account of something, a good author will sometimes keep repeating certain themes in either a person's life or a group's life to help you see what they want you to see about the history of the person or the people that you're talking about. And so when you read the Pentateuch, when you read these first five books of the Bible, there are some kind of reoccurring themes that show up over and over again, both positively and negatively. And a careful reader, as you keep reading and rereading it, will catch those themes. And one of them, I would suggest, and not just me, a lot of Bible teachers suggest, is that Moses, as this key figure, is sort of prefigured in the book of Genesis. So let me just note a few things about Moses, all right? Moses is like Adam, who meets God face to face. Like Adam, he meets God face to face. Now, more specifically, I would say God the Son, but he does meet with God. He's like Noah in that he's delivered from a water death by an ark covered in pitch. And he, should read, faithfully builds what God asks in the tabernacle as Noah built the ark. There is a picture there. In fact, if you're a Hebrew reader, you would see in some of the terms that are used in Exodus are almost identical to what's used with Noah. He's also like Abraham in that he's divinely appointed to go to a land flowing with milk and honey. And he's like Jacob, who gave final blessings upon future generations. Deuteronomy 33, he ushers these blessings upon the people of Israel. Same thing that Jacob does at the end of his life. Now, the Jews, of course, held up Moses as a great and wonderful teacher. I mean, they almost assigned him like a divine-like status, right? I mean, even when Jesus came, they always were comparing him to Moses at some level. Which, of course, the great irony is that actually, I think, is what Moses wanted his readers to see. I'm going to give you a little preview about next week's sermon when we get to Deuteronomy 18, is that Moses promises there's going to be a better prophet, one who speaks like me, that was to come. In fact, that's one of the key things throughout the Pentateuch, is there's this idea of the world is cursed by sin, God is intending to do something about it, and he's going to do it through a human being. And all along the way, we have these human beings that they get close to doing great things. You think about Noah, I mean, great man of faith. Last we see of him, he's a drunk. Whether he intended to or not, it's not a good ending. Abraham, great man of faith, leaves his country, goes to the place where God tells him, you know, he's got a lot of great moments and some not great so moments. And you go down the line. And even Moses, of course. I mean, Moses is rescued by God's divine hand. He's taken from the Nile River, placed into this great place of prominence. But what's some of the last things that we really remember about Moses? Did he enter the promised land? And the answer is no, because he did not actually fully fulfill the word of the Lord. So the Pentateuch, and Genesis is part of this, is always pointing us, and here's a big theological word, but it's an important word, to an eschatological reality. Eschatology means future. So a lot of people, when they read the Old Testament, Christians, they think about that's just past. Actually, I think if you read the Old Testament rightly, it's constantly pointing us to there is redemption, there is hope, it's coming. It wasn't in Noah, wasn't in Cain, wasn't in Seth, wasn't in Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. It's not even in Moses. But there is something coming. So God has chosen his people. Moses is a central figure, but he is even himself pointing to someone beyond himself that would come. So those are key themes in the book of Genesis, of the Pentateuch, excuse me, and we should read Genesis in light of that. Let me just pause and ask any questions at that point. All right. Number three, much of the narrative sections of the Pentateuch, including Genesis, illustrate the whole of the Pentateuch and the Mosaic laws, or those cultic regulations. And they do so both positively and negatively. Positively and negatively. So, let me give some examples. We can consider Abraham. Positively, Abraham offered sacrifices. That's the kind of thing that's encouraged by the Mosaic Code. So, the people of Israel could see, as they're being formed as a nation, this is what we should expect. Our forefathers did this. Jacob did this. Isaac did this. Abraham did this. They offered sacrifices. Right? It's encouraged. More than encouraged, commanded. But of course, negatively, you shall not bear, thou shalt not bear false witness. Abraham lied about his wife. And we can consider the severe consequences of these actions. So sometimes what's happening in the narrative of the Pentateuch, the story, true story part of the Pentateuch, the narrative of the Pentateuch, including Genesis, is that along the way, we see divine illustrations of what God commands in his law. All right? So, you know, there's commands in the law about marriage, for instance. Right? And you see divine illustrations of what happens when you mess up marriage. Right? I mean, think about Abraham. I mean, the whole idea of bringing in Hagar, how did that work out for Abraham? How did that work out for Sarah? So you have law, and then I'll use the word carefully here, you have story, it's true story, that illustrates the law positively and negatively. right? You know, you could say the same thing, by the way, about Jacob, you know, taking two wives plus two concubines, right? Law illustrated with story doesn't end well, or at least has huge part of the problems, huge problems for the family along the way. So the story parts, you should sometimes think about them in light of the law parts and vice versa. They actually illustrate. And here I'll push this a little bit further, and this is for you really want to read the Pentateuch carefully, is that sometimes in the laws that Moses gives, he's giving kind of like, this is what we have to do in a fallen world, but it's not the best. So for instance, in the law, it does allow for people to have a second wife under certain circumstances. But if you read the whole of the Pentateuch, starting from Genesis all the way through Deuteronomy, every time you see that kind of thing happening, it doesn't end well. So you have case law that Moses gives, and you have illustration to show, yes, this is permissible because we live in a fallen world and we have to deal with things as they are, but it's not the best. If we did things a little bit differently, you can see this illustrated in Jacob's life and so on. And you can point that out in other areas as well. So the Pentateuch, positively and negatively. Let's look at actually a specific example. We can see in Genesis that events foreshadow God's future blessings upon Israel. So let's take our Bibles, go to Genesis 12 for a moment. So here we're being introduced to Abraham. He's moved into the promised land. And then we come to this problem beginning in verse number 10. Now, there was a famine in the land, and Abraham went down to Egypt to dwell there, for the famine was severe in the land. And it came to pass, when he was close to entering Egypt, that he said to Sarai, his wife, "Indeed, I know that you are a woman of beauty, beautiful countenance. Therefore, it will happen when the Egyptians see you that they will say, 'This is his wife,' and they will kill me. But they will let you live. Please say that you're my sister, that it may be well with you, me, for your sake, and that I may live because of you." So it was when Abram came to Egypt that the Egyptians saw the woman, that she was very beautiful. The princes of Pharaoh also saw her and commended her to Pharaoh. And the woman was taken to Pharaoh's house. He treated Abram well for her sake. He had sheep, oxen, male donkeys, male and female servants, female donkeys, and camels. But the Lord plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. And Pharaoh called Abram and said, "What is this you have done to me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife? Why did you say she is my sister? I might have taken her as my wife. Now therefore, here is your wife. Take her and go your way." So Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they sent him away with his wife and all that he had. Now, do you see any really important word in there that shows up later in the Pentateuch? What do we got?
Plague.
Plague. Plague. Now, let's remember that we've been talking about the first people that received Genesis, and all of the Pentateuch. People of Israel. These are people that have been wandering for 40 years in the wilderness. Moses is about to die. They're about to do this crazy hard thing about crossing into a foreign land that they themselves have never been in before. They've never stepped foot in that land. They're going to go in there, and God says, "Don't worry about all the really powerful peoples in there. We're going to take care of them. You're going to win. You're going to defeat them all." You know, and they're in this wilderness period, and they've been there for a long time, and all of their parents and grandparents are all dead and gone, right? Largely all dead and gone. And they're now, they haven't been to Egypt, But they heard stories about Egypt. Egypt, you know, at least there was safety, there was plenty. We've been in this wilderness, now we're going to go to this land. And oh, by the way, Moses says, when you get there, you're not going to have manna and quail anymore. Right? So these are huge steps of faith. How could we know that God was going to be with us, that is going to be with us? How could we know that? Well, there's this repeated theme that shows up in Genesis and in Exodus, and that is that God delivered his people out of difficult situations. Even, by the way, when they're the ones that messed up. So Abraham goes down to Egypt. Now, there's a famine. He goes down there. He lies about his wife, gets himself in a lot of trouble, and yet God delivered by means of plagues. All right? And by the way, people of Israel, God did that again for your people 400 some years later when he brought them out of the land of Egypt. God delivered by plagues. And by the way, don't you remember, we'll allude to this briefly here this morning in this morning's message, don't you remember that when we're wandering in the wilderness and the Amalekites came and attacked us, that God delivered you then as well? We'll talk about this in more detail this morning. And don't you remember that even when the king of Moab tried to bring a curse upon you, that I prevented Balaam from doing that, God delivered you then? So there's these reoccurring themes that come up over and over again. God delivers, God delivers, God delivers. You're about to cross into the land of promise. And guess what I'm going to do for you? I'm going to deliver. Over and over and over again, you have these themes. So there's key words that if you're a careful reader, as Moses intended, you're going to go, oh, this is like that, which is like that, which is like that. Themes that keep coming up again and again. So when we read the Pentateuch, we read it in light of the Pentateuch. All right, before I move on from this whole section, you got questions, comments? Yes?
The people that were under 20, while they didn't see some of them, obviously, the crossing of the Red Sea and that kind of thing, wouldn't the seeing, like the pillar of fire, and the pillar of cloud, I mean, that's a miraculous event, or seeing Mary become leprous and then becoming clean, or to me it seems like there were miracles that were going on, not like parting of the Red Sea, but still miracles that were going on during that time frame, that they should have had their eyes open, that this God can do something.
Absolutely. I don't think one is exclusive of the other. So yes, they did see miraculous events, such as the defeating of the Amalekites, when that happened in their eyes. And some other lesser peoples as well that tried to give them grief while they're in their wilderness wanderings. And like, as you mentioned, the pillar of fire, manna, quail. So that's not to deny that. It is to say, though, still, it's still a massive act of faith. You know, like, I think it's hard for us to grasp the significance of that because we live in an era where the idea of going to a new place is not as scary as it once was. I mean, today, of course, it's especially true with this, you know, wonderful little thing called the internet, right? Is that before I go to a place now, I've already looked at detailed maps. Google can give me street maps. You know, I can actually look at the, you know, if you're going to stay at an Airbnb, you get the address, you can go to Google, and it actually shows you a picture of the front house, and you can make sure that actually matches what Airbnb or VRBO gives you. But even if we were around the clock 50 years ago, you had trade magazines of showing, like, where you're going to go. People could tell you stories about what it's like. You know, there's debates about the size of the people of Israel. Let's say 2 million, 2.5 million people as they're getting ready now to cross into the promised land. They've never seen that. There were no magazine photos. There's no newspaper articles. And we're going to go there and, you know, right away we're going to be confronted with people that are going to be opposed to us. And we're supposed to conquer them. Israel had not had, over those 40 years, extensive battle experience. They had some limited battle experience, but not much. So I think that there had to have been a certain fear in that. So, yes, the miracles that were seen along the way in their wilderness wanderings, very important. But also to look back and say, look at how God has provided and he's planned for this all along the way. There's also another important theme that comes up, and that is that, when God brings the people of Israel across, they are, for a significant portion of the Canaanite people, were to devote them to destruction, to absolutely annihilate them. Right, that also requires some explanation. Why? Right, and if you go back in Genesis, you can see that there's a reason why Abraham and Isaac didn't want to have a wife from those people. So there's a whole bunch of themes that keep coming up in Genesis to say God's with you, you are justified in these actions. And so you got to read them in that light. So I don't think that they're mutually exclusive to say, yes, there's miraculous events in the wilderness wanderings. Totally agree with that. And that should let them know God's with them. But also, their past history shows God has been planning this all along the way. You have a purpose and a reason to be there. That's a good question. Did I help with that? Tan.
When a plague is identified as any affliction that's grand enough or great enough, either personal or collective, that falls outside of a normal sort of explanation.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Yep. Yeah, it's not just a general, our family got the flu today. So. Good. How much? It's glare on the clock. Got 5 minutes. Let's see here. I'm going to stop there. I'm going to stop there because we'll want to make sure I got enough time for the next section. And other than one guy in the front, nobody usually cares if the preacher ends early. So, all right. So we'll give you a few more minutes to hobnob and enjoy some good fellowship. All right. We'll see you for the morning service.